This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Don't look for too much medieval imagery in a hand-drawn Bible being displayed at Illinois Wesleyan University starting tomorrow.
While Donald Jackson was working on the parable of the prodigal son was when the Twin Towers were hit. So Donald memorialized that by actually including the Twin Towers.
Judy Valente talks with Jim Triggs about the St. John's Bible, plus mayoral reaction to the historic preservation outcry in Normal over the potential Trail East development project, and reaction to the meeting in Bloomington about a catalyst project. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A catalyst project in downtown Bloomington has been common currency in public discourse for several months now. The city has held a joint meeting with members of the Connect Transit and Bloomington Public Library boards to start talking about this idea, whether to knock down the aging Market Street parking garage and build a new library and transit hub in its place. Joining us is Alderman Amelia Burgs to talk about that meeting, and with her is GLT's Ryan Denham.
Thanks, Charlie. Amelia, I want to start with what were your initial takeaways from last night's session?
Well, I was very glad we were able to get to the table to begin a conversation with some of our community partners about their needs in the community and in the downtown area, and how and what opportunities might exist for collaboration.
The format of last night's meeting was sort of interesting. The aldermen were split up at different tables. They were paired with library trustees and Connect Transit trustees. You were in one of these small groups last night. You were sitting with a library trustee, a transit trustees, and Alderman Mboka Mulamwe, who supports the library staying put on Olive Street. So what are some of the things that you learned personally from the four others at your table?
Well, I thought it was great to have them broken out into those smaller sections, because in an audience of that size or a group of that size, I think it's oftentimes hard to give everyone a voice, allow everyone to participate. And at our table, everyone was fully participating in that conversation. It was really fascinating to me to hear the different perceptions, the different levels of knowledge from the different individuals and the different entities, and really the different perspectives they brought to the table. Because when it comes to the library board and Connect Transit, I mean, they're advocating for what's best for their institutions. And it was helpful for me as a council person to hear that and to better understand what it is that they need and what it is that they might ask council to do in the future.
Well, so much of last night was kind of focused on the merits of this idea potentially, but there are some real politics at play here, and I want to ask you about that. Judging from the past comments from the council, there doesn't appear to be, as of today at least, majority support among aldermen for moving ahead with this transit library project as presented. Why isn't it time to move on? The city has quite a lengthy to-do list.
Yeah, we do have a few things on our plate that are, and all of them, of course, are high priority. But this notion that perhaps the library would may or may not become part of a catalyst project is not new. And it's actually in the task force report. We recognize that it may not be feasible or even desirable by city council to include the library in a catalyst. We took that into account, but enough people in the task force thought it was worth having this conversation. If a majority of city council is committed to expansion on site or wants to continue to pursue that conversation, I completely understand. There are alternatives here, because even if the library is not part of this conversation, we still have a potential partner in Connect Transit for a transportation center in downtown Bloomington. And we also have this looming issue with a Market Street garage that is aging. We need a plan for it, and we don't have a plan.
Three of five aldermen who didn't even want to meet with the Connect Transit and Library Boards did not attend last night's session. The other two who did attend, but they expressed some concerns about how that meeting came together, the process, how involved aldermen were in kind of the format of things. Alderman Boka Malamwe said mistakes were even made during that planning process. What's your response to those concerns?
You know, it's unfortunate because overall, it does distract from having the bigger conversation, which is how do we keep things moving forward? How do we make progress in the downtown area? How do we meet the needs of the library and Connect Transit? And it's also, you know, it's a little bit, it's unfortunate also because there were opportunities to become engaged earlier. For whatever reason, those opportunities were missed. So it's just unfortunate that there are now individuals who are dissatisfied with the process. But I'll say this, process, you know, I mean, that's an infinite possibilities when it comes to process. You ask five people how to run a meeting, you're going to get 10 different answers. So I would just hope that people would engage when they can, but at the end of the day, come to the meeting prepared to discuss those bigger pictures and to try to really move forward. Because I'm very interested to hear more from those aldermen who want to the library to expand on site. I want to hear more from them about why they think that is the best option and why it is they support that. And I really haven't had the opportunity yet to hear that to a very large degree.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Alderman Amelia Burgess, chair of the Downtown Task Force. She's here in studio to recap last night's joint meeting between the City Council and the Connect Transit and Bloomington Public Library Boards. Amelia, you've made the case that library expansion at its current location on Olive Street is no slam dunk either, that there are some potential issues with even that plan that need to be folded into this discussion. What were some of those concerns?
Sure. And I do want to caution that the fact that I'm raising questions does not indicate that this project is fatally flawed on site, right? There is no such thing as a perfect project. All projects of this scale will have trade-offs. They will have pros, they will have cons. But I personally believe that the sooner we start discussing some of these cons, the sooner we can start dealing with them and wrapping them into that planning process. Because the worst thing we can do is to have some factor that has not been taken into account during the public conversation, and then to come up when it's time to make a decision. That doesn't lead to better outcomes. That doesn't lead to better confidence in the system and whatever the ultimate result is. So there are a number of questions that I think need to be discussed further. And I've identified some of those, one of the primary ones is looking at the different costs and what that means. We've gotten more information, but we still need more information moving forward. Some things during our last year's June meeting we didn't discuss was, for example, moving public works. What will that cost? Do we have to move all of it? Can we move part of it? I can't answer all those questions now, but I can tell you that some of the numbers we have discussed for moving public works is in the range of $5 to $15 million, probably centering somewhere in the middle there. We also haven't robustly discussed to the extent that further development of the library parcel, what impact will that have on the nearby residential area? Because that's a very fragile area. The Dimmitt's Grove neighborhood is identified as a regeneration zone in our comprehensive plan. And I certainly would not want to do anything that could undermine those efforts.
And you kind of go through some of these topics in a post on your Facebook page this morning, focusing on 10 things specifically related to expansion on Olive Street that you think the public should know more about. One of those was that the city probably can't afford both a downtown catalyst and a library expansion separately. And you ask this question of which is the higher priority, right? Is it the library or is it downtown? But I think library supporters might push back on that a little bit. It's not like the city hasn't spent money on downtown in the last 10, 15 years, right? You've had the Coliseum, you've had the BCPA. So is it really an either or at this point?
Well, I think that's more a function of limited financial means. You know, if you were to ask me, money is no object. What do? I say we invest in downtown, we invest in the library, whether it's separately or together. And this is not a new idea. I've talked about this since last year, this notion that when push comes to shove, we may have to make a decision. We may have to make a choice between expanding the library and furthering revitalization efforts in downtown, efforts that have gotten even more pressing and more imminent with recent news and the continued difficulties and challenges the downtown area is experiencing. And my position has always been, that's not a choice I want to make. I mean, the library is an important institution for our community. Downtown is vital to the continued health of our community, not just for Bloomington, but for the entire community. And so I think it is responsible of us to ask the question, if we can combine these needs into a single project, will we be better off? we'll be able to do more together than we can alone. And when we throw Connect Transit into the mix, I'm certainly excited about the possibilities there for, again, for that notion, can we do more together than alone? But realistically, what we need now is more conversation, more information. I mean, the message I got from last night's meeting is we've got a lot of homework to do. No matter what direction we go in, we have a lot of questions that need to be answered. All the stakeholders need to continue to educate themselves about the different issues facing their own entities, let alone the bigger picture. So this is a process we can't shortcut.
To that end, the Bloomington Public Library's board president, Alex Cardona, and director, Jeannie Hamilton, were there last night. They made the case that they've been waiting around a long time for what they say is a much-needed expansion. They said they've racked up even $2 million in deferred maintenance costs as they've been waiting for the council to move ahead on an expansion. Do you sense a little frustration there coming out of library leadership about how long it's taking for kind of final movement on this? And is there any concern that the Catalyst discussions might be slowing that down a little bit?
You know, I think there's a strong desire to move forward. And what does that look like is a different question. But I think there's a very strong desire to move forward because they have clearly making the case for the need to move forward. And they need an answer. If we're not going to be able to support them financially with a major project for expansion, then their decisions will be different than they are if we will be supporting them. But that being said, you know, I think that does provide some impetus to have this conversation on a shorter timeline than we may have. I don't think we should take years to have this conversation. But if we take a few more months, or we expand that conversation, because there's still a lot of work to be done on the on-site expansion plans. Maybe we expand it. Maybe we say, okay, if there's enough value or interest in looking at a Catalyst project in downtown, maybe we vet both those projects. And then we compare and contrast, and we choose the one that seems to best meet our needs, the one that we can afford, that is most affordable for the community, and the one that gets the community support. I see that as a huge benefit to the community to have options.
Well, as the council continues talking about this, what are the tangible next steps coming out of last night? I understand the facilitators are going to be sharing some notes back out of that meeting last night. What's coming next?
Sure, and I think everyone's anxious to see that feedback from the facilitators because we all had our own different memories of the process last night. We, you know, certain things stood out in our memories that will allow us to be reminded of maybe some other things that were said, so we can begin to focus that, but I'm hoping that this is the beginning of the conversation and really not the end, because, again, we still have these pressing issues facing the city. We'll narrow things down as we go through the process, but we can't shortcut it. We need to continue moving forward, continue that really robust process of getting more information.
That's Alderman Amelia Burgess, chairman of the Downtown Task Force and one of the most vocal proponents for the Library Transit Catalyst Project. I'm Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal is closer to a new building in Uptown, north of the Circle and east of the Constitution Trail. Town Council members approved moving forward with developer Bush Construction, based in Iowa, on a development agreement for the $29 million building. GLT broke the story on January 4th in an interview with City Manager Mark Peterson. And here to talk more about the new structure proposed for Uptown is Mayor Chris Koos, who joins us regularly following council meetings. Chris, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Good to be here.
A couple of opposition points arose quickly when GLT first reported this story, and I'd like to get your reaction to both of them. Let's talk parking first. What sort of value does the parking lot that would go away and become this building provide to Uptown?
Well, all the parking wouldn't go away, but obviously a significant amount of it would go away. There is a lot of parking available in Uptown Normal, and it's going to require people to take a different mindset to it. You know, I'm told people by people that they will not park in parking decks. That's just a deal breaker for them. But I think if there's enough activity down there that draws people in, they'll change their ways.
What is the land worth?
That's a good question. And we haven't had that discussion with a developer yet. There are a lot of those kinds of decisions that have to be made. You made reference to a $29 million building. Well, that was a concept, a $29 million concept. We don't know what that building is going to end up being. There are just a lot of moving parts in it. Basically, what we did last night was to say we like your development team and your philosophy on what you want to do with this with these properties down here, and that's why we chose them.
What about their philosophy is welcoming to the town?
The fact that they were trying to do a lot of the financing themselves, the fact that they had a multifaceted finance stack, loans, the TIF dollars left on the on the TIF, new market tax credits, things like that.
Let me return to parking. You'd mentioned there is plenty of parking, but it's not only that. It's the perception and the perception of space in the downtown. One of the original points of the FAR report was to create open spaces and vistas to look down. Does a five-story building in that location cut down the vistas and make Uptown Circle a chillier place, potentially?
Absolutely not. It does not at all. And in fact, the building massing was shown, not the building itself, through the what the building will look like, is very consistent with the FAR plan. In terms of the vistas going up and down Constitution Trail from the circle east to Linden Street, those vistas are created. And the idea is to have an urban density at the core and have it step down as it goes to the edges.
Are there ways to combat the reluctance to go to parking decks or the perception of difficulty of parking, if it is available?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think if people want to be in a place that they're enticed to a place, they'll do that. I mean, look at downtown Chicago. Street parking, forget about it.
At one point, the town was discussing making parking decks free and charging for on-street parking to increase use of the three decks in Uptown. Is that discussion still viable?
I think it's still viable, but it needs the merchant groups, the retailers in Uptown at the table to agree that that's a better solution than what we have now.
Where does it lie?
We haven't had the discussion in a while, but I think if we get some more density down there, we're going to have that discussion. You know, in a parking demand study that was done a while ago, the concept was that if you're 85 to 90% parked on the street, you're okay. But if you're having to drive around the block repeated times because there's no parking, that's a problem. And that's where you want to start thinking about metered parking.
And what is the situation down there?
It depends on the time of day.
Yeah. Is there potential for abuse of free spaces in the deck if you move that direction?
You know, I don't think we'll ever go to free spaces in the deck. I just don't see that. That may have been a discussion years ago, but I don't see that happening now.
Okay. The other negative reaction to the proposal for the Trail East structure is the mural on the side of 104 East Beaufort and the three structures, 104, 106, and 108 East Beaufort. Are these buildings historic?
It depends on who you talk to. Are they characteristic of a period of the town of Normal? Absolutely. Are they in good shape? They're in relatively good shape. So they're of a kind. They're not landmark buildings by any means.
How about the value of the mural?
The value of the mural, you can't put a dollar amount on. I mean, it's something that people like. I've talked to other people that said, yeah, it's kind of cute. Some people are very tied to it, some aren't, and that mural's been there for 4 years maybe. There's always opportunities to do new ones.
Okay. at the start of the uptown planning process, and I date myself, more than 15 years ago, city staff and the council people and mayor, you at the time, said that the uptown revitalization process would change the character of the area. It would force rents to rise and perhaps end some mom-and-pop businesses and force them out to the fringes of uptown where the rents would still be lower. Has that happened?
I think in a sense, you know, it depends on the condition of the property. If it's a brand-new property, or if it's an older property that has been had a substantial restoration, we've had both of those. The economics of that force those rents higher.
That's part of the concern of what is going on with these buildings, right? Is it about to happen or accelerate?
You know, that has not been vocalized. It's something I understand as a retailer.
It has been vocalized on social media, but
okay. You know, that was not an issue that was brought up in the comments last night. You know, as a retailer, I understand this concept very, very strongly. And there are, you know, there are buildings down there that are probably renting for $12 a square foot for retail space, and there are some that are probably $20 to $23 a square foot.
Who owns 106 East Beaufort?
You're going to have to help me with the which building.
It was 104 on the edge, 106, and then 108.
A gentleman out of Chicago owns 106.
Okay. Is it a deal breaker with a developer if the buildings don't go?
You know, we've not had that discussion. They will come to us with a concept plan and for the frontage that they need on the circle and frontage they will need on the circle, not for the offices that have been negotiated, but for the retail space. If there's no retail on the circle, it's not going to function very well on Constitution Boulevard.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Chris Koos of the Town of Normal. City Manager Mark Peterson characterized this as an economic development project. What do you think?
I think it is. I think there's a strong economic development component, and for the current merchants and new merchants in that area, it's going to be a boon. I mean, you're going to have somewhere in the neighborhood to 225 to 275 office workers down there day to day. Probably haven't, many of them haven't walked into your businesses, which will now because of the adjacency of where they work to those locations. The restaurants will do well. The hotels will do well because a couple of these companies do have people that come into the community. So, yeah, it can be an economic development issue.
The FAR firm indicated that a few years ago that Uptown needs several more restaurants to really be a dining district, with the one in Uptown 1 that has yet to be announced. And by the way, are we close to that?
I'm not sure. We talked to the developer of that project, and he's kind of wrapping up getting the residential component of that done and is in active conversations with restaurateurs about that property.
And the retail or potentially restaurants in Trail East, how is that enough of a critical mass to be a dining district or to attract one more somewhere else in Uptown?
You know, that's a hard thing for me to say. Yes, you know, there's a magic number that's a tipping point. Now you're a dining district and now you're not. You know, we've had some ebbs and flows on that in the Uptown area.
How do the two firms that want to be tenants there, Farnsworth and the other unnamed tech firm, along with the retail and the housing, mesh with what the Uptown plan says about the mix, particularly the housing?
You know, early on, it meshes very well because it was always designed to have a mixed use and an 18-hour street life. And so the fact that you have daytime office workers down there and then people that live there year-round helps to make a vibrant central business district.
Who is the unnamed tech firm?
Unnamed Inc.
Okay. There are 5,000 to 6,000 square feet of unnamed tenant. Mm-hmm. When will we know?
That's their decision for them to announce. And we always leave it to the tenant or the project developer to make those announcements. That's not our call.
Speaking of things we may know soon, we understand the council has interviewed at least one candidate to replace City Manager Mark Peterson. How goes that process?
I think we'll have a decision fairly soon. Council may be considering another interview. We did an interview yesterday, and we got pretty close up to council meeting time, so we weren't able to finish our discussions on that. But I would think fairly soon you'll know who the new city manager will be.
Do you bring that person back if you didn't finish, or is that the council
part
of the
discussion?
No, it's
more of a council conversation.
Okay. How many finalists are in the hopper?
Can't say.
You've interviewed one. Mm-hmm. You indicate the possibility of at least one more.
Yeah. And you know, there might be another if we don't like what we see in the other one.
It's somewhat traditional, although not universally observed, to make the names of finalists public. So far, you haven't done that. Why not?
Because we're not quite sure who the two or three finalists might be. It's more likely going to be two.
Does the public need to know that?
That's a good question. I guess it depends on which public you're talking to.
Okay. Which two or three publics are you considering? And why not? Why not make it public?
Because we haven't made a decision. I can't say there's candidate A, candidate B. I can't tell you that for certainty.
That's Mayor Chris Koos. Mayor, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Absolutely.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal are regular guests on Sound Ideas. Next week, you'll hear from Mayor Terry Renner. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The new year brings new opportunities to stay in step with a changing world.
These are the largest demonstrations in Iran in nearly a decade.
Opportunities to learn.
But the main reason for the surge has to do with global economic conditions.
And opportunities to be surprised.
It has Kahlua, chocolate syrup, and red Kool-Aid.
All you have to do is listen to Morning Edition every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, offering Reduced Shakespeare, performing Shakespeare's long-lost first play, a funny and fictional weaving of famous speeches and plot devices from the Bard's works. Friday, January 19th. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Laura Kennedy and GLT's Grow. The St. John's Bible is the first hand-painted, handwritten Bible created in more than 500 years. It was a major undertaking sponsored by St. John's University in Minnesota to celebrate the millennium. The Bible contains elaborate calligraphy as well as illuminations, that is, artwork using precious metals. The original Bible never leaves the library at St. John's, but fine arts copies of individual books in it do. Starting this week, the New Testament and Acts of the Apostles will be on display at the Ames Library of Illinois Wesleyan University. Judy Valente has more on this project in this interview with Jim Triggs, one of the St. John's Bible curators.
St. John's University is a school run by Benedictine monks. In the Middle Ages, monks were civilization's scribes, copying and creating Bibles and other significant documents. In celebration of that Benedictine tradition, St. John's engaged sage Donald Jackson, an Englishman who is the official calligrapher to the British crown. Jackson wanted to create an illuminated Bible for today. Jim Triggs, who is a curator of the St. John's Bible, says that resulted in some surprisingly contemporary images brought to life by ancient artistic techniques.
One of the things that we try to do when we show illuminations, we don't share the illumination and describe it. What we try to do is get people to talk about it, that this Bible is very communal. That is, unlike a cell phone or a smartphone where it's just you and this phone and it's very singular, what happens with this Bible is you open the pages, and much like we had in the lobby just now here at the radio station, all of a sudden four or five people came around and they said, look at this and look at that. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the most important aspects of this project, the fact that it really invites people to participate and enjoy.
What kind of spiritual experience has it been for people who see it?
For people that are familiar with the Bible, It's interesting because they typically have their favorite verse or their favorite part of the Bible, and they want to go to it, see how it's treated. I've heard numerous occasions where a relative of someone who invited somebody to come see the Bible, and of course the relative came reluctantly, and they were really mesmerized, and there was sort of this sense of awe when they saw it. But when they see it and they hear the story of the St. John's Bible, they come to me and say, thank you so much for inviting me. This has really been inspiring. There's certain things that you can enjoy on the internet. This is one of the things that you really have to see live and in living color to really appreciate it. And so we're really thrilled that Illinois Wesleyan is going to have it on campus to share.
You're not going to see a lot of medieval symbolism or imagery in this. There's really a lot of modern contemporary references in these illuminations.
Yeah, absolutely. A really good example of that is in the Luke parables. There's a series of parables in Luke that are celebrated. The parable of the lost coin, the lost sheep, the Good Samaritan. And while Donald Jackson was working on the parable of the prodigal son was when the Twin Towers were hit, so that very day. And so Donald memorialized that by actually including the Twin Towers in the genealogy of Jesus at the beginning of Matthew as a way to celebrate the humanity of Jesus. You'll see the double helix DNA molecule. So that makes a theological statement that we believe Jesus was truly human, but it also is a timestamp of sorts. So someone 1,000 years from now will say, oh, this must have been done after the 1950s because that's when the DNA molecule was discovered. You'll also see images of microscopic images of the AIDS virus and the leprosy virus, and yet on the other side of the scale, you'll see images of deep space taken by the Hubble telescope. So it was really meant to sort of capture the world today and celebrate knowledge and understanding that we know today in a way that would resonate. But then you'll also see icons, beautiful Eastern icons by Aidan Hart, which is very traditional, especially in a number of the illuminations in Gospels and Acts.
Why did St. John's University in Minnesota want to do this project in an age where you have graphic design, you can do all kinds of things on a computer? They hire artists to hand paint and do hand calligraphy of the whole Bible.
Donald Jackson, at a very young age, had this dream of handwriting the Bible. In fact, he told Barbara Walters that on the Today Show back in 1979 that was his dream. And he was always looking for someone to partner with. And we got to know him because we would host calligraphy conferences up at St. John's. And in 1995, he basically pitched the idea, what if you, St. John's, a Benedictine institution with the rich heritage of illuminated manuscripts from the past, hire me to handwrite a Bible using the same tools as medieval days, but capture the art and capture the essence of Christianity at the beginning of the 21st century and make it a gift to the world in celebration of the millennium.
You mentioned Benedictine there, and we should explain that the Benedictines are the founders of Western monasticism, and they were the scribes.
Absolutely, and there's some beautiful manuscripts. If you think of the Book of Kells and many other great manuscripts of the past, it was more often than not, it was Benedictines that were doing that, and they were really capturing history. So we look at the St. John's Bible not just as a celebration of a beautiful book arts that took place many, many years ago. But if you think about how much we learn from past civilizations through the books that we have now, the St. John's Bible is meant to be a gift for future generations as well. So imagine someone looking at this Bible in the year 3017, 3018, and they see Hubble-esque images in our illuminations, and they'll look back and say, oh, that's such a 21st century take on life on Earth.
Well, you're using the term illumination, and maybe we should explain what that is in terms of this Bible project.
So an illumination is really nothing more than a beautiful picture or illustration that has metallic material that reflects light. and whether it be gold or silver or platinum. In the St. John's Bible, those illuminated pieces, those pieces that reflect light, actually represent the presence of the divine, the presence of God. And so they're sort of used strategically and artistically in each of the illuminations.
And there's actual gold leaf in it, as I understand.
Gold leaf and silver leaf and platinum. As a matter of fact, the materials that we use in the St. John's Bible are identical to what you'll find in the Book of Kells and other illuminated manuscripts. And the idea of using those materials is not so much to recreate history, but rather, if you look at the Book of Kells, it's in phenomenal shape. So we have the same sort of vision for this, using these organic materials like calfskin vellum and gold leaf and these organic minerals that are used for the paints and so forth. You know, we have this vision of it still being in great shape in 1,000, 2,000, maybe 3,000 years.
What exactly will people see at Illinois Wesleyan? What has Illinois Wesleyan gotten from St. John's University?
So unfortunately, the original manuscripts we have to curate. So we have to worry about temperature and humidity control, and we can't let people touch it, and it's very valuable, and we have to watch how much light is exposed. One of the reasons why we actually created what we call the Heritage Edition. So if we go back to the mission of the project, the mission of the project is to ignite the spiritual imagination of people around the world of all faith journeys. So how does a small university in the middle of Minnesota from Lake Wobegon reach the world? And the main way we're doing it is through the Heritage Edition. So we created something that is as close to the original as possible. And one way we did that was we had Donald Jackson be the artistic director of these volumes. So these are limited edition volumes, and they're true to the artistic intent of the original. And we're making these available to universities. So we have something called the Year with the St. John's Bible, and that's exactly what Illinois Wesleyan is using, is taking advantage of. So we're actually going to have a volume on campus for a full year.
Now, people are not going to see the whole Bible. Let's not get people too excited out there. They will be seeing a part of this Bible. What part of the Heritage Edition will they see?
These volumes are so large. They're about a foot and a half by 2 feet in dimension, and we can't bind all the entire Bible from Genesis through Revelation together. And so we've divided the Bible into seven volumes, and the one volume that will be here has the four Gospels and actually the Apostles.
The work that went into this, I mean, this was a humongous effort that involved numerous artists, but just talk about the specifics of how they went about this job.
Yeah, it was daunting, and much more daunting than anybody thought. I think they knew it was going to be daunting going in, but it's one of these things that was even more daunting. So Donald Jackson, again, it was his idea, but he's an artist. He's not a theologian. So one of the first things he said to St. John's is, okay, you're going to have to give me a little bit of direction. I need some scholarship behind this. And so what St. John's did was they put together something called the Committee for Illumination and Text. And this was a combination of biblical scholars and theologians and artists and art historians. And their job was, we want this to be a Bible for the 21st century. We want something that resonates with the world today. So themes like care for the poor, care for the sick, the dignity of all people, the embracing of science and discovery, the glorifying God's words. These are some of the major themes that we wanted to capture in the art. And so that the scholars would write briefs for certain verses and areas of the Bible, and then Donald would take these verses, and then he would assign certain artists that he knew to do the illuminations. So there was a team of the six artists that did the bulk of the work. And there was also six calligraphers. And the six calligraphers, unlike the artists who brought their own traditions to bear, the six calligraphers were all trying to do their calligraphy in the same style.
Same style, right. And I think you mentioned to me at one point that it took 12 hours to do just one page of this hand-painted calligraphy?
Yes, it would take 8 to 12 hours to do one page. They would sort of manage this by having the same calligrapher work on facing pages so that your eye can't pick up the difference. And then they would typically do the calligraphy first and leave space for the art. Most of the calligraphers were in and around Wales, but the art came from artists from around the world. So unlike monastic times back in the medieval days, these pages were flying all around the world. They would leave space for the art, maybe roll up the piece of vellum, and they would ship it to a studio in California. Thomas Ingemeyer is one of the artists who worked on this in California. Suzanne Moore at the time was in Ohio, so she would have pages sent to her. So that's one of the big differences between medieval times and today. We were sort of leveraging the fact that we have artists from around the world that participated in this.
So you have these pieces of this artwork flying around the world. How did St. John's University, as you say, a liberal arts school in Wobegon country, pay for all this?
Yeah, that was another big one, because like every other college, we've got all sorts of pressures. We want to make sure we have scholarships available and building funds and faculty needs to be paid and so forth. So Brother Dietrich Reinhardt, who was the president at the time, and his team, Rob Culligan, who was in charge of institutional advancement development, they did a very good job of reaching out to sort of non-traditional sources. So one of the companies, which is surprising, that put a fair amount into this early on was Target Corporation. So Target put about $3.5 million into this project, and they really viewed it as a beautiful work of art. And there was a series of exhibitions that they helped sponsor, and there was also quite a few non-traditional donors to St. John's who came forward that heretofore had not been that actually knowledgeable who St. John's was, but they fell in love with the St. John's Bible. But there's also lots of individuals. We took donations of $5, and there was Boy Scout troops and Girl Scout troops that donated to this. So I'm not sure if this number is correct, but something in the order of like 1,500 different donors made this possible.
And the overall cost was, in the end?
Yeah, we don't disclose that. We think as much as the Boy Scout and Girl Scout troop that donated as much as the $1 million donations. So it's something that the university doesn't disclose, but it was definitely in the millions.
Has this project revived an interest in calligraphy and the almost lost art of illumination at one point?
Well, I tell you, it's one of the people that I think has done a lot of revitalization of calligraphy is Steve Jobs, and the impact it's had on Adobe PostScript and the kind of fonts that we now use in everyday life. I had an experience at a college where one of the calligraphers, Diane von Arx, was actually doing calligraphy out in the hallway prior to her talk. You would be amazed to see the students who were gathering around, and what she would do as a courtesy would, she would do their name in beautiful calligraphy. And again, calligraphy is a form of art. It's very, very beautiful, and just that sheer beauty of it draws people in. And so, yes, we've seen a lot. And also, in every city, it seems like there are calligraphy guilds that come out of the woodwork to see this Bible. They either know Donald Jackson, or they've read his books, or they've taken classes from Donald Jackson. And so, yeah, we think it's having a big impact.
Illinois Wesleyan University's Evelyn Chapel was able to obtain the reproduction of the New Testament on loan through a $9,500 grant from the Merwin Multi-Faith Fund. Wesleyan kicks off its year-long celebration of the Bible with a free lecture by Tim Turns of St. John's University tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. in IW's Westbrook Auditorium. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Outdoor furniture takes a lot of punishment, but if you want your patio to look as good as the plants you care for in your landscape, on this edition of GLT's Grow, Patrick Murphy has advice on keeping that lounge set looking great all year.
Taking care of your plants is only one part of the equation in looking after your yard. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Laura, good day.
Today on GLT's Grow, it is a good day because Murph has advice on caring for garden furniture. And, you know, there's a whole slew of different styles of furniture, different materials out there. So, you know, we need to be up on the best way to keep that stuff looking good and lasting.
That's right. And it's costly, and you don't want to have to repurchase it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not too late. So if it's still sitting outside, I can give you some tips on how to preserve your investment. Mm-hmm. And besides, you know, you do all that hard work in your garden, you reward yourself and your family first and your guests last. And this is where it all takes place a lot of times, is in the outdoor furnished areas of the landscape.
Okay.
So what I've done to try and make it easy for everyone is to group it into some categories, and I'd like to start with teak and the hardwoods. That includes ipe.
Ipe, I've never heard of.
Ipe is like a nautical wood, but it's oftentimes found in very nice high-end furniture.
Oh, like at the Yacht Club.
Like at Thurston Howell's house.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So all of these wooden-type furnitures are best maintained with a mild soapy water to kind of prepare yourself to go on to the next step. Mm-hmm. You could do the mild soapy water and stop right there, but you're missing an important step in preserving the grain that furniture is made out of. after you have done your initial soapy water light preparatory cleanup, if you found some spots where there's maybe scratches on the armrests where the wedding ring taps every time you sit down, or if maybe one of your guests had a pair of pruners on their belt or a pocket knife clipped onto their pocket and it left a big scratch, well, you can soften that scratch with some light grit sandpaper or even the triple aught steel wool. That's the softest steel wool. It doesn't even scratch glass.
Wow.
And bird droppings on all furniture is a big issue because it's very dirty. It's very unhygienic.
It's gross.
It's gross. And it leaves a stain. And this is one way to get that stain off of the top layers of the fiber or the material that the furniture is made out of. After you've done this surface preparation, now you're ready to apply either tung oil or teak oil. Teak oil is best for teak. Tung oil works on teak. It works on all hardwoods, and it works on the ipe also.
Okay,
works
tung
on
oil.
Any wood.
Hey.
Tung oil. Yeah.
All right.
T-U-N-G.
Oh, that
oil.
Kind. Okay.
That kind of tung oil. And, you know, a little bit goes a long way. You can dilute it with mineral spirits, you know, to make it kind of runny and to make it absorb easier into the wood.
Good tip.
And I think it's best to do this at the end of the season rather than to start your season doing this, because after you've applied the oil, whatever kind, to the wood, you can't sit down right away in that furniture. You've got to let it be absorbed and let it dry. So a great time to do that is when you're putting it away. That way, when the spring gets here, you whip the chairs out and you put your keister in it and off to the, you know, you're having fun right away. For best results, you want to also get your cushions and stuff like that stored indoors and wrapped up. That's really common sense on the cushions. It's not as detailed as the wood.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, we're making sure our garden furniture lasts.
That's right, Laura. And one of the things that we love about garden furniture and that we want to last is its color. So, you know, cedar has a color.
Mm-hmm.
The teak certainly has a golden brown color. If you use the teak oil on your teak furniture, not the same for tung oil, but teak oil has a UV protectant in there that prevents the sun. It does just as much damage as the grit and grime and things like that that accumulate on our furniture.
Okay.
When it comes to wood furniture, pressure washing is a terrible idea.
Oh.
And the pressure washers, unless it's very, very low pressure, which would be the pressure out of the end of a garden hose, that's okay.
Okay, but no professional.
Pressure washing is not a good idea because it can mar the wood. It can leave like little worm tracks. They appear to be little squiggles from where the end of the sprayer is too close to the wood or there's too much force. But it also injects water into the fibers, and then it can take a very long time to dry out, and you could basically inoculate your wood with the properties necessary for it to start decaying and rotting.
Oh my goodness.
By using the pressure washer. So don't do that.
Okay. Well, what if we have like concrete?
Concrete and the hard cast pieces, they're very forgiving. And there's a preference and taste issue here because some of the cement ware that you see in the landscape, over time it starts to age and the mold and sap falls from trees, and little particles of dirt and mold, they attach themselves to the cement or hardware, stoneware bench or furniture. And it looks neat. Some people like that character. So, but if it's something that you're still going to put yourself on and your guests on, you want to at least keep the seat areas and the places where the hands and forearms touch the furniture, keep those clean. This is different than the other natural products because you can use the power washer. You can also use soapy water.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also use a vinegar and water combination, a 4-to-1 water, 4 parts water, 1 part vinegar. And that'll help break up some of that grit that's on there. And you can just dump it on there and rub it around with a little brush and spray it off and you're done.
That sounds very low maintenance. I like that.
It is way low maintenance. Now, on the other side of the spectrum is wicker.
Okay.
Wicker's awesome. I love wicker furniture.
Sure. It's very Victorian. It's gorgeous.
And it, you know what? It comes in different colors. Wicker is the description of reeds and plant fibers woven into a form. And it's, I think it's very versatile because you can use it inside or outside. And it's light enough that you can pick it up and move it inside if it's raining, you know. And it has a lot of great selling points, in my opinion. regular dusting with a soft cloth or a fiber duster, and that's something that has like a rigid bristle that's soft on the end, a leaf blower, the brush head on a shop vac. Like, you know, if you got the shop vac for the carpet in the car, it works great on getting the dust and everything out of those little nooks and crannies in the wicker.
And needless to say, you don't want to be leaving that out in the wintertime. You can leave your concrete out, but you can't leave that out.
Yeah, it's not a good idea to, even if you have covers on it, because it can absorb moisture that's just in the air, especially
yes.
here in the Midwest. Today, it's fog city. If you had wicker outside on a day like today, with all this fog and moisture in the air, a lot of it would be absorbed by the wicker.
Right.
And it's a challenge to have enough room in one's home to bring all the outdoor furniture inside, you know, so choose wisely, grasshopper, when you pick your wicker. Now, the dry cleanup we talked about on the wicker, you want to also use a warm water or mild soapy water and wipe them annually. And again, if you can do that at the end of the season, you might be able to uncover them and put them right to use in the spring. You want to let them dry completely before putting them in storage, sitting on them, covering them. It needs to dry because the wicker, like we said, it's reed and plant fiber, and,
right.
and it'll hold water and it can rot quickly. And, you know, wicker couches and love seats with the big arms and stuff, they get a little bit of wear. There's some surface area there. And when a person sits down or gets up from their seat, they put lots of pressure on. And those are spots where the wicker can degrade. You can fix those areas just by kind of pushing the wicker back up with a screwdriver or something and put some wood glue on it. And after you're cleaned up, you've done your repairs too.
Great. Wonderful advice, Murph. Thank you so much on that. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, we're going to be looking at the reasons why a tree must be cut down. If you've got a gardening question or problem you'd like Murph to tackle, you can just go to our website, wglt.org/grow. There's a form there to fill it out. Send it along to us, and maybe we'll have your question on the air. We'd love to hear from you. WGLT.org/grow.
Download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet.